This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Risk and the American banker, the American economy circa 1973, and of course, some purple rain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 21st day of April, Thursday today. Good to have you along, as always, everybody. Prince and his economic legacy coming up in just a little bit on the program. First, though, no matter how hard we try to get away from it, Wall Street and the regulation thereof keeps on digging its claws into us. The specific topic du jour is executive compensation in the banking sector and how best to link it to the amount of risk that said executive takes. A consortium of six federal financial regulators, the National Credit Union Administration, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the FDIC among them, released a new set of rules this morning saying basically, you take excessive risk, oh banker person, you could lose a bunch of incentive-based compensation like bonuses. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser starts us off.
On Wall Street, big risk can lead to big payouts with huge bonuses for the risk taker. Cornelius Hurley is director of the banking law program at Boston University. He says a fixation on bonuses can lead bank executives to meet short-term goals so they get their bonuses, but they can hurt their company in the long run.
You can have the odd situation where the CEO makes his or her bonus targets, but the institution is doing very poorly.
Under the new rule proposed today, the executives taking the most risks at the biggest financial institutions would have to defer part of their incentive-based pay and might have to give back part of their bonuses later. Marcus Stanley is policy director of Americans for Financial Reform.
You actually do pay the bonus, but in the contract it states that there is a right to claw back that bonus if misconduct is later discovered.
That wasn't included in an initial rule proposed back in 2011 and part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. Regulators scratched that rule, coming back now with a stronger proposal. Why did it take so long? Well, there are six federal agencies involved, and banks lobbied them heavily.
It's a really sorry history.
Patricia McCoy teaches law at Boston College, and she says there will be more delays because the rule wouldn't apply to current bonus plans.
We could be well into the 2020s before this really kicks in.
But McCoy thinks if it is finalized and does eventually kick in, the rule would reduce excessive risk-taking. The public comment period on today's proposed rule ends July 22nd. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Four times a year, pretty much like clockwork, the business and economic world is captivated by what has come to be called earnings season, when publicly traded companies have to tell investors and the public how they are doing financially. It's been that way since 1970, but there's been some thinking lately that maybe quarterly deadlines like that every 90 days keep companies too focused on a very short time frame. It's an idea that's gotten some traction in the presidential primaries and also at the Securities and Exchange Commission. The agency has been doing some thinking about whether investors and companies and markets actually do benefit from quarterly reporting. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on that one.
Putting together all this financial data every few months, it's kind of a pain. Costly, too. So should companies do it less often? Well, no, says Ed DeHaan at Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Investors having more information seems to be sort of clearly better than having less information.
Perhaps the biggest complaint about quarterly filing is that it pushes managers into short-term thinking. But Tahan isn't sure how adding a few more months between reports helps solve that. He has a different idea.
Compensate that manager based on performance of that company over a long horizon. What's going to be best for the shareholders in the long term?
And while we're changing managers' mentality, we'll need to tackle investors too, says Amy Hutton at Boston College. She says companies give guidance, analysts issue expectations based on that guidance, and then companies try really hard to meet or exceed those expectations when they release their earnings. If they miss, investors can send a stock tumbling.
Part of the problem is that as managers got involved in the earnings guidance game, they gave investors this false impression that earnings are predictable, that they actually follow a nice upward time trend when they don't.
So quit the guidance games, agrees Robert Eccles at Harvard Business School. He also thinks companies should give more information, something called integrated reporting.
It's how a company communicates about how it's creating strategy over the short, medium, and long term. So instead of just talking about here's how this quarter was, here's how it compared to last quarter, you're taking a more holistic view of a company's performance.
You change the conversation because he says changing the schedule probably isn't realistic anyway. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If Dow 18,000 meant something special to you, A, why? And B, today is not your day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From San Francisco today, the next step in what will surely be a very long unwinding of the Volkswagen emissions rigging scandal. A federal judge there has approved the outlines of a deal in which the automaker will either buy back or offer to repair nearly 500,000 VWs the company doctored to pass emissions tests. Dan Neal writes about cars and everything automotive for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
Do you think there's a realistic way to repair these cars, or are they lost and gone?
In the United States, there really isn't a easy fix to repair these cars. They have looked for a software fix to adjust for the extra NOx. But really, with these 2 liters, you got to do a lot of plumbing. You have to put in a urea injection system. It's just not worth it.
All right. So either Volkswagen buys them back or then what? I mean, if you own a VW, one of these 2-liter VWs, what do you do?
Well, you have a smorgasbord of choices here. They can buy it back from you for the price that it was before the crisis hit. You can terminate your lease without penalty. You can or cancel it. And there's going to be some money on the table for your trouble, something in the neighborhood of $5,000 per customer.
We should note, though, that the amounts being bandied about today, $1 billion plus or minus for this part of the deal, are not yet inclusive of the penalties that will be levied on this company. All in, give me a number.
Oh, no. This is more like the end of the beginning. I mean, this covers the civil cases, actions by owners and some from the government, but there's still regulatory and criminal actions to be pursued. The company set aside $10 billion for sort of the immediate fallout, but their real liabilities probably were more on the order of 30 billion euros over the course of the next 5 or 6 years.
If you're a Volkswagen dealer in the United States, how annoyed are you with this company?
Well, it's not been easy, let's face it. It's been a rocky marriage. I mean, Volkswagen has actually stubbed its toe pretty badly in the U.S. market twice, once in the 2000s and then this time. And they just built a beautiful new factory in Tennessee, mm-hmm. and they were going to add 100 dealerships. And all of that's come to tears because of this very dastardly conspiracy to hide these emissions. So, they're pretty mad. And some of them are suing in spite of the fact that there is supposed to be a compact among dealers that they would keep it out of the courts. Hmm.
Is there a case to be made here, given the Volkswagen thing, given the Mitsubishi thing from earlier this week, which granted are much smaller engine cars over in Japan? Is there a case to be made that we shouldn't believe anything any automobile company says about emissions and all that?
Yeah, I think this is the long-term fallout for this, is that any regulatory regime, self-certification, all of this is going to be under much closer scrutiny. Trust no one. The Mitsubishi case is another prime example. And why? It underscores the fact that these companies are trying to do asking too much of the existing technology. You're not going to meet next-generation emissions with this generation's powertrain and combustion solutions.
Would you buy a Volkswagen today?
I would. I think they're a really good company, and I think they have seen the handwriting on the wall. I think everyone's attention is fully focused. I also think that probably you go down to the dealership, they're probably dealing.
Dan Neely writes on cars for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Kai.
Come with me now, back to the week of November 24th, 1973, Thanksgiving week that year, as it happens. Why, I hear you asking? Because the economy, that's why. We learned this morning that first-time claims for unemployment benefits have fallen to just 247,000, and not since late in 1973 has that number come in so low. And in the idle moments of our morning news meeting today, somebody asked, what was the economy like in 1973 anyway that so few people were applying for unemployment? All right, that somebody was Mitchell Hartman. Here he is from our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
First off, in the fall of 1973, you would have been hearing this top Billboard hit on the radio. When I go round in circles. So to pick up on Billy Preston's lyrics, have we gone round in circles back to the good labor market of 1973 with low layoffs and unemployment claims? Not quite, says economist David Blitzer at Standard & Poor's.
I started graduate school in September of 1973, the 73-75 recession, which was a real dilly.
Blitzer explains, through the early 1970s, unemployment had been very low, 3 to 5%. There were plenty of jobs in offices and factories back then. Wages were rising strongly. Then October 1973, the OPEC oil embargo. Energy prices soared. Prices soared across the economy. Unemployment spiked to 9%. It was stagflation, says economist William Spriggs at Howard University.
It's the ghost that haunts us today. And post-1980, we've lived with significantly lower inflation, but significantly lower wage growth and much higher levels of unemployment.
If only we could get back to those rock-bottom unemployment rates and really good paydays now. As Jim Croce sang in his number one song for the week of December 29th, 1973.
If I could save time in a bottle.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He really refused to, you know, have his name be turned into something that was just a commodity for big business.
The singular legacy of one of music's greats. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 113 points this Thursday, 0.6%, 17,982 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 2 points, less than 0.1%, 49.45 there. The S&P 500 down 10 points, about 0.5%, 2,091. Viacom was a big winner. They gained 13% after making a multi-year carriage deal with Dish Networks. Verizon was one of the day's decliners, fell 3% after it reported that earnings might plateau in 2016. United Continental descended almost 10% today. That after reporting first quarter earnings were down a bit more than a third. American Airlines off 3%, Delta down 3.5%. Barbie's parent company Mattel dropped 5.7% today. The toy makers had a hard time reinventing that iconic doll, and sales of Barbie down 3% globally in the first quarter. Bonds down, the yield on the 10-year T-notes up to 1.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Queen Elizabeth is 90 years old today. Celebrations abound over in the UK. This weekend, there is going to be another cultural anniversary over there, 400 years since Shakespeare's death. Performances of his plays and readings of his sonnets are planned, festivities that will continue for the rest of the year. But there is a note of discord, a disagreement between two leading scholars over Shakespeare's money. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
On a walking tour of Shakespeare's London, we stop at what should be the most important landmark of his career.
So this is the Globe. We know that Shakespeare wasn't just the playwright and the actor, but also part owner of this building. So we know that he had some shares in this building here. So
except he didn't. The original Globe Theatre disappeared centuries ago. The modern replica was built in the 1990s. Tracing the bard's footsteps isn't easy, as the tour guide cheerfully admits.
You will have to use your imagination for quite a lot today.
For a literary giant, Shakespeare left a remarkably faint footprint in the physical landscape and in the historical record. There are only a few fleeting references to him. But Bob Behrman, author of Shakespeare's Money, says a clear picture has emerged of the finances of the bard and his wool dealer father, John.
Now, his father suffered, quite a severe financial disaster in the 1580s, leading William Shakespeare to leave Stratford and seek his fortune in the theatre to somehow reinstate the family's reputation.
A heartwarming tale, but not everyone is captivated.
It's a great story. Unfortunately, it makes no financial sense whatsoever.
David Fallow, a retired banker and Shakespearean scholar, has applied his financial acumen to the documentary evidence and concluded that
most of the Shakespeare family investments are made long before William could have made them from the theatre.
First, take the finances of the Elizabethan theatre, as spelt out by the rascally Mr. Fenniman in the movie Shakespeare in Love.
500 grundlings at tuppence a head, in addition 400 backsides at threepence, penny extra for cushions. Call it 200 cushions. Say.
Actors earned around £6 a year, playwrights about £5 a play, and yet Shakespeare bought the second largest house in Stratford for £60, and that's long before he acquired his share in the Globe. he spent more than £1,000, a huge sum, on property and investments.
If you look at what the sources of cash are, what any good banker would do, where's the money? And the money's with John Shakespeare. It's in the family business.
Fallow believes that John did not go bust. He just took his highly lucrative wool-dealing business underground and sent William to London to be his front man. So much of the Shakespeare fortune came from this. And not this.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
But Bob Bearman doesn't buy it.
There's no evidence of William Shakespeare ever being involved in wool dealing.
Or that his father retained his wealth.
As far as we know, he didn't even leave a will.
But the two scholars are agreed that William Shakespeare from Stratford wrote some of the finest literature on earth and left us all a priceless legacy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Don't need more than one word to set up this next item. Prince. He died today at the age of 57, as you've surely heard. His songs are, of course, at the top of the iTunes charts, but his influence went far beyond just music. Daphne Brooks is a professor of African American Studies, Theater Studies, and American Studies at Yale University. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Prince was a musician of singular ability. He was an activist. He was an economic force in an industry he didn't much care for, honestly. How would you characterize him?
He was the sound of post-civil rights freedom struggle. Hmm. He was the sound of blackness as capacious and as unapologetic and as eccentric, as wondrous, as imaginative as you could possibly think in our contemporary world today.
He was also an economic iconoclast, right? I mean, he did what he wanted, when he wanted, results notwithstanding. He changed his own personal brand. I mean, he took his name off his product for a good period of time.
Yes. He wrote Slave very famously across his cheek during his very famous disputes with Warner Brothers. Yeah. Some people chastise him for seemingly making light of, our great American disaster that was slavery. But really, he was a powerful legacy in the context of the popular music business with regards to racial issues. He really brought to the forefront of the cultural imaginary an understanding of how black artists had been exploited across the 20th century, still are, in the music business, and refused to, have his name be turned into something that was just a commodity for big business. He was an absolute groundbreaking presence in that sense, too.
It's worth the mention here that of the many boundaries he pushed was up against, I guess, society's expectation of what pop music ought to be. And I'm thinking now of Tipper Gore and the parental advisory language, which came from one of the Gore girls buying a Prince album and Tipper hearing it and saying, oh, no, we're not having this.
Yes, that was the high 80s, the culture wars, which we seem to never be able to get past. He was all about, trying to celebrate pleasure and trying to find a kind of pleasure and joy for black people, but also for a multicultural world that can understand the ways that black music gave the world pleasure.
At a time when maybe that was kind of rolling the dice sort of economically for him, right? I mean, he had the breakout hits, but early on it was a little dicey.
Oh, early on it was completely dicey. I mean, we all know the stories of, his early days in Minneapolis, playing in underwear, and just like, being a virtuosic guitarist and, not quite being welcomed by black radio or white radio. But also at the same time, really affirming, what blackness was to him, in the context of, again, the post-civil rights era. What does it mean to be free for African Americans in the wake of the civil rights movement? Prince is a symbol of that. He will always be that.
He came of age musically before we had the internet, before we had iTunes and all of that. He did not love digital music. In fact, I think he actually said at one point, I really don't like digital forms of music.
Yeah, he did. I think we have to understand him too as being a boomer. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but he had a certain kind of belief in craft and artistry and musicianship that was, very much indebted to kind of the core origins of popular music culture in the mid 20th century. But you think about the ways that his sound has influenced, a long line of artists who, do work in digital context, from Aphex Twin to Daft Punk, not to mention, again, a lot of the experimental African-American artists working across genres today. Again, I'm thinking of Janelle Monáe.
Yeah.
And, I think he what goes around comes around. And for Prince, he managed to remain present and current, even if he rejected certain kinds of definitions.
You must have been to a concert or two of his, huh?
Where do I start? We could start with Purple Rain, although I really wanted to be at the 1999 concert and my parents wouldn't let me go, for all sorts of reasons, but every time it was about thinking about what it meant for this musician to get up and being a kid who grew up listening to punk and new wave along with soul. He was somebody who embodied all of those sounds for me. He made me feel free. He made me feel liberated.
Daphne Brooks is a professor of African American studies at Yale, teaches a bunch of other stuff there as well. Professor Brooks, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, just a little bit more Prince. A couple of years ago, we did a live event, a stage show at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. A bunch of people talking to me on stage. And we had Misty Copeland, the ballerina, as one of our guests. And she and I had this exchange. We're just going to play the whole thing.
You did a series of appearances with Prince, in which you danced a blend, I guess, of some moves of classical ballet, but also some more interpretive contemporary stuff. I wonder how difficult it was for you to break from the rigors of classical ballet, the strict numerical definitions, and do what he wanted you to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I step outside of the classical realm, it's very easy for me, the more contemporary movements.
Yeah.
So when I first performed with Prince, I was just improvising, so it didn't really matter. I would just find the rhythm of the music and do what I wanted to. But when it came to performing with him in this big American tour at Madison Square Garden, he was very strict about what he wanted. And surprisingly, even to this pop rock music, the song The Beautiful Ones, he had me listening to this song over and over and over again so that if for some reason something went wrong, I could step in and know exactly where I was in a phrase of music and be able to carry on from there.
Tell the story of you were on stage once fronting for him, basically, and the crowd goes wild as you do some arabesque or whatever, and you turn around. And
That was the times of my improvising days with him. Yes, I was out there, and I had no idea how much time, how many phrases of music I actually had to improv. He just said, go out there and do something. So I did, and I was going on for a while, and finally I did a big grand battement, and the audience just went wild, and I was like, wow, they really liked that. I should do another one. And then I turned around, and he had entered the stage, so I slowly backed away.
That was a pretty good story, right? The Dow off 113 points today, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ down 2 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, about 0.5%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. Props to Daisy Palacios for the Prince soundtrack on the program today. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.